Welcome, everyone, to the Timmy Talks podcast. I'm Nick Marston, here with my co-host, David Berg. And on today's show, we'll be joined by cardiologist, clinical trialist, and a mentor of ours here at the Timmy Study Group, Dr. Christian Ruff, who will discuss the world of factor 11 inhibitors and his recent late-breaking clinical trial, Azalea Timmy 71.
Well, Nick, it was certainly an exciting AHA scientific sessions in Philadelphia. Always fun to connect with friends, meet new people, take in the latest science.
Absolutely, David. I actually had two interactions related to the podcast. The first was that I actually did cross paths with one of our prior guests, Bob Harrington, a couple of times, actually. And so it was really nice to meet him in person. And as you might expect, he did refer to some Boston sports and the troubles that the Patriots are having. I then also did meet a fan of the podcast that had reached out. She's a senior resident who's currently applying to cardiology. Yeah. And so we were able to meet up and talk about research opportunities, fellowship applications, et cetera. And so it was really just fun to interact with the full spectrum from cardiologists who are just starting their training all the way up to past presidents of the AHA.
No, totally. I mean, I actually had a couple chances to interact with Judy Hockman, another former Timmy Talks guest. So that was great. But you're right, you know, interacting with trainees, both residents, fellows, is a particularly fun part of these meetings. And, you know, we actually had a great dinner on Saturday night with our very own Timmy fellows.
That's right. It was really a fun dinner, fun time for sure. And if I recall at that dinner with the fellows, you really just couldn't stop talking about the Mint trial from the moment we walked in. So perhaps that's a good place to start our high-level recap for some of these trials. And maybe we could each pick a trial that caught our attention. And we'll defer Azalea for the deep dive, of course.
Okay. Yeah, well, I guess you picked mine for me. I'll go with Mint. It's true. I do have a soft spot for these, you know, these large pragmatic trials that tackle fundamental questions related to routine clinical practice. And that's exactly what Mint was. It was a labor of love. It enrolled for more than 6 years, multinational, publicly funded. And it asked the question of whether a restrictive hemoglobin transfusion strategy, so a threshold of less than 7 or 8 grams per deciliter, was better than a liberal transfusion strategy with a threshold of less than 10 grams per deciliter with respect to a primary endpoint of myocardial infarction or death at 30 days in patients with acute myocardial infarction. Now, given the totality of the evidence for restrictive transfusion thresholds in other clinical settings, I have to admit, I was fully expecting that a restrictive transfusion strategy would be better, but that's not actually what was seen. You know, in fact, the trend favored the liberal transfusion strategy in this particular population of patients with MI, most of whom had NSTEMI, and many of those were actually type 2 MIs. Now, because of the particular pre-specified analytic approach that was used, the trial narrowly missed statistical significance, but the trend was clearly there. What I think was particularly interesting was that there was directional consistency in the effects on both MI and death. So really, I think, this has important implications for clinical practice and decisions that we make all the time related to transfusion. Nick, what about you? What caught your attention?
Well, first, I totally agree. You know, you sold me. It is very interesting. Maybe not Saturday night dinner worthy, but certainly I think is going to make us think twice on the wards. I'm going to go with a no-brainer, the SELECT trial, which headlined the Saturday morning session. You know, we'll certainly have to have a dedicated episode for SELECT, but I think it bears mentioning today, as it's the first trial to demonstrate that treating obesity actually reduces cardiovascular events, even in the absence of diabetes. So really kind of changes the way we think about obesity. The reduction in cardiovascular events included reductions in MI, coronary revasc, and while they couldn't state this statistically or claim this, it does appear that they reduced heart failure and all-cause mortality with semaglutide as well. So I think it's a total game changer as it impacts the way we view obesity, which is clearly a disease, and how we treat it in the clinic.
I completely agree. I mean, it really is amazing if you sort of pause and think about the story of the GLP-1 arrays. It's really sort of incredible. And I think this class of therapies is really going to make a huge impact on cardiovascular health. So many other great studies. We could keep going on and on. I'll just have to give a little shout out to Orbita 2. I thought that was great. First sham control demonstration that addressing epicardial coronary stenosis with PCI objectively decreases anginal symptoms in patients with stable angina. So I think that was an important proof of principle trial for our field.
Yeah, a lot of trials we can get into in future episodes, which it's always great to have a lot of material for that. But today we really want to be doing a deep dive in Azalea Timi-71. This was another late-breaking clinical trial presented at AHA by our own Christian Ruff. Dr. Ruff is the director of cardiology at Brigham and Women's Hospital, an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, and a senior investigator at the Timi Study Group, where he's focused much of his career on factor Xa inhibition in AF. And now he's studying factor 11 inhibitors as the search for the perfect anticoagulant continues. We really hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the podcast, Christian. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today.
So you had a busy weekend in Philly with a highly anticipated late-breaking clinical trial presentation. And then, of course, all the fanfare before and afterwards.
Right. Well, the tough questions from you guys, my colleagues, was very helpful. Thank you.
Right, exactly.
The preparation.
Right, the preparation.
Right. No, exactly. Well, and I don't know if you've heard this enough, but I want you to know you look great up there. The hair,
thank
makeup,
you, yeah.
Outfit.
I'll tell awesome. My hair and makeup consultant that they did a great job. Thank you very much. And my wife for picking my suit and tie.
There you nice. Go. It takes a village. It takes
that's
a village.
Right. Team effort.
Right. And no, the science was okay, too.
Yeah. Secondary. It's all about how you look and what you say.
No, but it, you know, really, you were awesome. I have to say, it was really fun to watch you on stage.
Well, thank you very much.
And I'm curious, sort of, for you, any notable highlights from the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously, you know, we do clinical trials for a living, but it, you know, obviously, the late break having an opportunity to present at a late breaking clinical trial is really so exciting. Just the enthusiasm and the buzz. And, you know, one of the things that was different for me, I've, you know, been Timi for a while, been a clinical trialist, but it's the first trial that I've been a part of where a DMC ended the trial early for good reason. Obviously, a DMC can end the trial for bad news or good news. And so I think what was exciting is because the DMC ended the trial early for overwhelmingly positive results, and that was kind of the buzz and the press going in, I think it was just really exciting because it generated an enormous amount of enthusiasm and expectation going into the meeting. And so it was a whirlwind a little more than 48 hours, but it was just so exciting. And it just, you know, reminded me of, you know, when I was a fellow and becoming a junior faculty, you know, how much doing a good clinical trial and the science matters to be able to be a part of a celebration when a trial goes well and it's well executed and the results are really important. Hopefully the clinical community, it was just, you know, it was a really special feeling. And then it's over and we get back to the busy work. But it was phenomenal. It was a phenomenal time. I'll always remember. And thank you everybody who sent me pictures while I was on stage so I could send to my kids so they think I was doing something at least important for the weekend when I just did soccer practices.
Yeah, to the future trialists.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's fun to hear. And it really was exciting to see. And I know you've done like dozens of interviews this weekend as a result, and appreciate you joining us to do at least one more.
This is the most important one.
Yeah. We won't be too hard on you. You know,
yeah, you're... thank you.
but, you know, with regard to the excitement, I want to shift to really the science, the factor 11 inhibition, which really is an exciting space. And obviously, you've been very involved in furthering our understanding of the use of DOACs and
right.
their benefits in atrial fibrillation compared to warfarin, including helping to lead the Engage AF Timi 48 trial. But now with the Azalea Timi 71 trial, you know, you're looking for the next best thing in anticoagulation,
right.
and you're moving from factor 10A inhibition right. to factor 11. So could you describe for our listeners, you know, what are the unmet needs that our current approach is not meeting, and why are factor 11 inhibitors holding such promise?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think it's a fair, you know, we have, you know, people say, hey, you yourself, Christian, you 10 years ago, you were telling us what a great advance DOACs were. We've had anticoagulation for over half a century, DOACs now over 10 to 15 years, you know, why do we need another anticoagulant? And it is true that the DOACs were a major advance over warfarin. We know that warfarin, you know, which we used for half a century, was highly effective That wasn't the problem. It was one of the most difficult and dangerous drugs that we continue to use in clinical practice, mainly because the risk of intracranial bleeding, which has a 50% mortality rate. And the DOACs, when we look at meta-analyses of those trials that we were involved with here at Timmy and others, they were great drugs. They were just as good as warfarin in reducing ischemic stroke, but their real advance, they were markedly safer with respect to serious or life-threatening bleeding, basically because of 50% reductions in intracranial hemorrhage. That alone led to a 10% all-cause mortality benefit of DOACs over warfarin. And that's a huge advance, and I think we were very excited to bring the DOACs to clinical use. The problem was that if you looked at less serious types of bleeding, the advantage of DOACs was really more mixed. While they tended to decrease major bleeding in general, which is essentially bleeding that leads to hospitalization, there was heterogeneity across the class, and they basically all, for the most part, increased gastrointestinal bleeding by about 25%. And we know GI bleeding in an AF population is like 2/3 or 3/4 of the hospitalized bleeds we see. Mm-hmm. And what's the end result of that? Well, somewhere between 30 to 50% of patients who have atrial fibrillation, a class one, you know, guideline recommendation for anticoagulation, are not prescribed it, don't take it, or are getting the wrong dose. And so that's a huge percentage of patients who are not getting effective therapies. And we know these patients, if they're not on an anticoagulant, are at fivefold the risk of stroke. Fivefold. Yeah, wow. And the issue is, you know, unfortunately, we've been on this quest, you know, sort of like the Holy Grail. We need a safer anticoagulant, because even with our best anticoagulants now, bleeding or even the perceived risk of bleeding drives substantial undertreatment of patients. And mm-hmm. that's why really factor 11 has emerged as a promise of the sort of the next platform of anticoagulation. And the reason for that, Nick, as you mentioned, is the hematologist, you know, my eyes always glazed over with the coagulation cascade and still do. But hematologist said, you know, there's something special about factor 11. You know, that actually is where we need to go. And I'm like, you know, I've heard this story before. You know, an anticoagulant that doesn't prevent bleeding. If I had a nickel for every time I've been in a meeting where someone said that. But it actually is quite unique. You know, if you look at, you know, why do we have a coagulation clotting cascade in the body? To perform two things. The main issue that we want is there are good clots and bad clots. Good clotting is you injure a blood vessel and you're bleeding. You want to form a clot, a hemostatic plug, because you need to stop the bleeding. So we want that. But obviously, we don't want to develop a pathological thrombus. Is when there's a thrombus that forms that occludes blood flow to a vessel and you get end organ damage, like a stroke in the brain. And the issue with the 10As or 2A inhibitors or warfarin is that the good clotting, the hemostatic pathway, and the bad clotting, the thrombosis pathway, all converge to a central downstream pathway. And the DOACs and warfarin interrupt that central pathway. So you get both. Yeah, very effective. Prevents strokes, but you still get bleeding. And factor 11, interestingly, only sits and is active in the thrombosis pathway. And so it's necessary to get that exponential thrombus growth and propagation needed to form a clot, say, that causes a stroke. But it's relatively dispensable, plays a really minor role in forming a hemostatic plug as part of natural vascular hemostasis. So it's been hypothesized that it's a hemostasis steering anticoagulant, that you could prevent clotting without causing bleeding. And we know, based on genetic data, people are walking around with complete absence of factor 11, congenital factor 11 deficiency, which is not that uncommon, especially in certain regions. And we know those patients don't seem to bleed spontaneously, don't seem to bleed with surgery, at least most surgeries, and have lower rates of stroke, heart attack, and venous thromboembolism. And so people have wondered, like, wow, that's pretty strong genetic epidemiology. You know, maybe we should develop an inhibitor. And essentially, you know, we were fortunate to present really, I think, very exciting results for abelacimab, which is a monoclonal antibody to factor 11.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's great when there is a genetic epidemiologic story that sort of sets the foundation for the question, and I think this is a good example for that. And so, I think the world of Factor 11 inhibition has really kind of exploded in recent years, and I guess at some point we can get into the different agents that are being tested. But one of the approaches, of course, is to inhibiting Factor 11 is a monoclonal antibody, right? And so that's the approach that you tested in the Azalea TIMI-71 trial. So I wonder if maybe you can tell us a little bit about the investigational agent, abelacimab, and then walk us through kind of the basics of the trial design.
Yeah.
And if I can preempt one more question, which is one of the things that struck me about your trial design was the fact that you guys had picked rivaroxaban as the comparator. And so maybe if you could touch on that too.
Yeah, no, and I think that's an important point. And abelacimab first, and as we'll talk about later, one of a couple factor 11 inhibitors. It's somewhat unique mechanism of action as it's an antibody. It's a very highly selective, fully human monoclonal antibody. It actually has a very unique mechanism of action where it binds to factor 11. And factor 11 exists in an inactive state. It's a zymogen. It has to be activated in order to do its business, and its business is creating clots. And what the monoclonal antibody does, it binds to it irreversibly and actually prevents factor 11 from being activated. So you never generate activated factor 11. And that's an important distinction compared to some of the other direct factor 11A inhibitors. So it's a monoclonal antibody, prevents formation of activated factor 11. Very highly selective, very potent inhibition, which I'll get to in a minute. It had been studied in obviously phase one and phase two. And one of the important things for Azalea is actually we have some of the best data that abelacimab is effective in reducing clots. And as is done in most anticoagulant development sort of pipelines, it was used in total knee replacement because we know those patients are at risk for periprocedural venous thromboembolism. And in a phase two open label randomized controlled trial, a single dose of IV abelacimab before total knee replacement reduced venous thromboembolism by up to 80% compared to standard of care prophylactic enoxaparin. And that it was using, say, the 150 milligram was the top dose in that, which is one of the same doses we used in the Azalea study. So we knew using doses that we were going to use in AF, that those doses are highly effective in reducing venous thromboembolism. And we know historically that drugs that have been effective in reducing clots in VTE has translated very well to the arterial side, particularly stroke prevention, atrial fibrillation. So we already had proof that this monoclonal antibody was very good at reducing clots. So gave us a lot of hope that this is a great agent potentially for atrial fibrillation, where our objective in the Azalea TIMI-71 trial, which was a phase 2b study, was to really fully evaluate the bleeding profile of abelacimab relative, as you mentioned, David, to rivaroxaban in patients with atrial fibrillation at moderate to high risk of stroke. So this was meant to be the definitive study of not just abelacimab, but factor 11 inhibition. Is does it live up to its promise? Is it really safer than standard of care DOAC? Because that was the entire premise of developing the factor 11 inhibitors, that they were going to be safer. And there has been phase two studies with other agents, secondary stroke prevention, a very small atrial fibrillation study with one of the other agents, but we really didn't have any, I think, really conclusive evidence. And this was going to be the largest trial prior to the phase three studies that are ongoing. And as you mentioned, there were three arms to this study: abelacimab 150 milligrams sub-Q monthly, so it's a long-acting monoclonal antibody; abelacimab 90 milligrams sub-Q monthly; or rivaroxaban standard dosing 20 milligrams or dose adjusted to 15 in selected patients. And as you mentioned, we used rivaroxaban, and people will ask, well, how do you pick rivaroxaban? There are four DOACs. I think it's a legitimate question. Rivaroxaban worldwide is actually the second most prescribed DOAC after apixaban. But it's actually, if you, this was a global study conducted in North America, Europe, and Asia. And actually, rivaroxaban is one of the most, or is the most widely available DOAC in the world if you look at access by countries. And so, you know, part of it is we wanted to use a DOAC. We wanted to use a DOAC that was commonly used. But because we were doing a global trial, we also wanted to use one in the countries that we were in that there was clear, you know, access for patients as well. It was something that they were using in their countries. And I think it's a fair question, and we'll get to this in the results, is, you know, do we interpret the results any differently, say, versus rivaroxaban versus apixaban? Because the question comes up, you know, apixaban's the safest DOAC. So, you know, if you show us the results are positive and there's less bleeding, is that just because it was rivaroxaban? What would it look like against apixaban? I think that's a fair question because there's some difference in major bleeding between those two drugs. But I think when we go through the results, to jump to the gun, the results are so substantial and overwhelming reductions that, you know, really doesn't matter which DOAC you compare it against. I think the results would stand for themselves, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah, that's a helpful background, Christian. And, you know, you successfully enrolled over 1,200 patients with AF, and as you said, moderate to high risk of stroke based on CHA2DS2-VASc, and really large global footprint, 95 sites worldwide, North America, Europe, Asia, with this 1-to-1-to-1 randomization testing the two doses against rivaroxaban. The median follow-up was 1.8 years, and the primary endpoint was major or clinically relevant non-major bleeding. And so, now we'd really love to hear kind of you share the primary findings with us and what you thought when you first saw them. Were there any surprises that stood out?
Yeah, I think there was. And I want to first mention, because just it's important with respect to the presentation, you know, as you mentioned, this was an event-driven trial for, we were targeting 166 major clinically relevant non-major bleeds. That's what we were powered for. But well before we hit that target, we were alerted earlier this year in September that the Data Monitoring Committee had unanimously recommended to terminate the Azalea trial because of a substantially greater than anticipated reduction in major and clinically relevant non-major bleeds, our primary endpoint, in both abelacimab arms compared to rivaroxaban, with a benefit-risk ratio favoring abelacimab. So that was certainly a good but shocking announcement to us. Yeah. We immediately proceeded with orderly closeout for the trial. Actually, closeout is still ongoing, hopefully ending soon. But we reported at the AHA data based on the last DMC snapshot. And so at that time, median follow-up had been 1.8 years, which is 15 times more the amount of patient years than any other study of a factor 11 inhibitor date. So although stopped early, still a wealth of information really kind of advances our understanding of factor 11 inhibition. 87 patients at that time had experienced a primary endpoint, which is 52% of the planned 166 events. You know, credit to our investigators, did an amazing job. Low rates of premature drug discontinuation, less than 5%, withdrawal of consent low, almost no patients lost to follow-up, so well-conducted study. And I think the patient population reflected who we thought we would enroll. They were 74 median age, which is what you'd expect for an atrial fibrillation population, 44% female, high CHA2DS2-VASc score, CHA2DS2-VASc of 5, so a pretty high-risk patient population, about 15% had a prior ischemic stroke, 7% had bled before. I think one of the interesting things that was very different from the DOAC versus warfarin trial, almost everyone had been on an anticoagulant at baseline, 92%. Back in the olden days when we did the DOAC versus warfarin trials, that was 60%. Most, you know, a good chunk of the patients were anticoagulant naive, where it's easier to show a bleeding benefit. But here, 92% had been on an anticoagulant. In fact, most of them, about two-thirds of DOAC. And so I think, you know, this was a population that was very reflective of what we see, moderate to high risk, a lot of them anticoagulation experienced. And I think as a trial, we wanted to show two things. One, does this monoclonal antibody do what we thought? It's a factor 11 inhibitor. Well, how does it inhibit factor 11? How much? And it's a potent factor 11 inhibitor. The 150 milligram dose reduced factor 11 from zero baseline to 3 months by 99%. So almost eliminated factor 11, basically recapitulating congenital factor 11 deficiency. And the, even the lower dose, the 90 milligram, a 97% median reduction in factor 11 activity, although it was somewhat broader range. So very potent inhibition. You're essentially eliminating factor 11 from the body. And so it works very well. You know, how does that translate? You almost completely inhibited factor 11. What does that look like? And when we saw the results, I mean, even knowing that the DMC stopped the trial, so we knew the results were going to be good. Yeah. I think we were still shocked by the magnitude. You know, the 150 milligram dose reduced major clinically relevant non-major bleeding by 67%, the 90 milligram by 77%, which is just a substantial, way more anticipated than what we anticipated. Though that's a very significant reduction. And even when you look, you know, take out the composite and look at major bleeding alone, which, as I mentioned, is really bleeding that leads to hospitalization, you know, was even more impressive, 74% in the 150 milligram arm and 81% in the 90 milligram arm. And I think the thing I was most surprised and I was actually hoping for the most was gastrointestinal bleeding. As I mentioned, that's the real bane of existence with DOAC therapy. That is why most of my patients either won't take a DOAC or stop. That was almost eliminated with abelacimab entirely, with 93% reductions in with both doses. And I think that, you know, the reduction in bleeding in general, major bleeding, the profound 70 to 80% reduction, and then almost eliminating GI bleeding. I mean, that really, to me, cements that inhibiting factor 11, even potently inhibiting factor 11, is just markedly safer strategy for anticoagulation than we've had really with any other of the options we've had for half a century. And I think that's exciting as we turn to phase three.
Yeah, I mean, that is just a spectacular result, right? The results speak for themselves. And I think as you know, to piggyback on the language you said earlier, this was really a definitive experiment in comparing the safety of factor 11A inhibition or 11 inhibition to factor 10A inhibition. And so I think, you know, we can really say with confidence that this approach is better from a bleeding standpoint. Now, of yes. course, you know, this wasn't a trial powered for efficacy with respect to mortality, all-cause mortality or ischemic stroke, for example. But you did share with us earlier that there yes. is some data from abelacimab in other contexts and VTE prevention about sort of efficacy with respect to thrombus formation. What's on the docket for abelacimab in sort of the AF space and in terms of demonstrating efficacy with respect to stroke prevention?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, obviously, That's why we're developing anticoagulants to prevent stroke. And so that's an incredibly important question. And that's really the purview of the dedicated phase three trials. And so, you know, we were underpowered to really look at efficacy. And so for abelacimab, really the efficacy will be defined. And it's actually an ongoing phase three trial. Currently, it's the LILAC-TIMI 76 trial, which is a phase three randomized double-blind trial of high-risk patients with atrial fibrillation deemed unsuitable for currently available anticoagulation, enrolling approximately 1,900 patients. Primary endpoint of that trial will be ischemic stroke or systemic embolism, and patients will be either randomized to the abelacimab 150 milligram sub-Q monthly dose or placebo sub-Q monthly. And the reason for this design is, you know, if you said, I've developed a super safe anticoagulant, the bleeding is markedly less, you know, who would benefit from that? Clearly, you could say, well, if it's effective and incredibly safe, everybody with atrial fibrillation. But I think we could all agree that if you had to pick one patient population that has the biggest unmet need, the most vulnerable patients, it's that 30%+ of patients who we know aren't getting anything currently because of the risk of bleeding. And so we decided to go after that very vulnerable, high-risk patient population. They're old, they're frail, they fall a lot, they have a lot of comorbidities, to say this is a perfect potential match for them because they're completely unprotected from stroke. And so that is the focus of the abelacimab effort for atrial fibrillation. There are two other phase three trials for abelacimab being done in cancer-associated VTE against active comparators. One is against apixaban, standard dosing in patients with gastric malignancies. So that's, again, a very high-risk patient population for both thrombotic and bleeding events. And then one, I mean, sorry, that's against dalteparin. And then one in general for cancers associated malignancy, not specific to GI, that's being done against standard of care, apixaban. So we'll get data of efficacy and bleeding both in a high-risk AF population, cancer-associated VTE. We're a placebo-controlled trial in very high-risk patients. And then there'll be two VTE trials against active comparators, one being apixaban and one being a low molecular weight heparin.
Well, that's very exciting. And like you alluded to, then beyond the abelacimab program, there are other therapies targeting factor 11 inhibition. And, you know, not unlike what we had for DOAX,
right.
We hopefully will have multiple options. And there are other drugs in late stage clinical trials. So it's always fun to kind of compare and contrast these novel agents within a new drug class and kind of help to understand what's coming. I know there's the Librexia program and the Oceanic program with phase three trials in AF and other disease spaces as well. So could you kind of walk through these and describe some of the key differences across this class of drugs?
And I think it's an important question. And I agree, it's great to have multiple options. And at least if we focus on AF to begin with, because there are multiple phase three trials in AF, There are basically three compounds being developed for AF, abelacimab, monoclonal antibody we mentioned, and then there are two small molecule inhibitors of activated factor 11. One is asundexian, that's in the Oceanic AF study you mentioned, and the other is milvexian in the Librexia AF. And so, you know, they're all factor 11 inhibitors in general, but the mechanism of action is very different. As I mentioned, the monoclonal antibody is a long half-life. It also prevents activated factor 11 from ever being formed. And so it's really recapitulating the congenital factor 11 deficiency. A small molecule works actually very similar to the direct 10A inhibitors. Factor 11 can be converted normally to activated factor 11, but then the direct small molecules bind to it when it's circulating, you know, chases it down before activated factor 11 does its business and forms clot. And so they work in fundamentally different ways, even though they're factor 11 inhibitors, you know, and we'll have to see whether clinically that matters, whether you know, preventing activated factor 11 from forming entirely to begin with, or having it formed and then inhibiting it with the reversible small molecules, whether that makes a difference. And so, but the mechanism's different and it's important to understand that. Other obvious differences is, well, the small molecules have short half-lives. And so they're dosed very much like the DOAX, once or twice daily they could be given, and a shorter onset or offset. And so that's some of the issues that may play out clinically. Obviously, short half-life allows you to start and stop. Although with the long half-life, if the drug is so safe, I think it also challenges the paradigm. You know, do we need to be stopping and starting an anticoagulant if the bleeding profile is so safe? Ideally, just like when we give PCSK9 inhibitors, GLP-1 inhibitors, if there's not really an adverse safety issue, you know, for compliance, maybe you'd want to be on a long-term therapy. One of the things we're excited for in Azalea is we actually have an extensive experience of patients having procedures done fully therapeutic on abelacimab. And so I think that data, and we know bleeding, periprocedural bleeding was counted towards our primary endpoint. We'll share specific data on periprocedural, but we know the rates are very low. And so I think that might challenge how we think about anticoagulants and say, hey, you know, for compliance issues, long half-life, maybe there's even an advantage as long as it's very safe to administer around procedure. So I think that will be important. But obviously, the most important thing is, you know, how do these agents perform in phase three? There is a difference in the trial designs. Those two small molecules are being studied in very large phase three randomized controlled double-blind trials against apixaban. And so the LILAC TIMI-76 high-risk patients deemed ineligible for anticoagulation, these will be used in studies against standard dosing apixaban. So I think that will also be very important. I will add that just announced asundexian, one of the small molecules, is also doing a study, Oceanic Athena, which is a similar design to LILAC. But I think great for the field. We'll have four trials in atrial fibrillation, two active comparator against apixaban, two placebo controlled. So I think we'll have an enormous wealth of data, just how effective these drugs are against placebo, against standard of care apixaban, but also how safe they are as well, even against placebo. And so we showed markedly safer than standard of care DOACs, but a higher bar for safety when you're going against placebo. So I think in the next few years will be really exciting for this field. I will just add that, you know, I'm a biased. I'm doing, you know, love stroke prevention and atrial fibrillation, but the small molecules are also being developed for secondary non-cardioembolic strokes. So strokes not due to atrial fibrillation. And milvexian is also being studied in patients with ASCVD and acute coronary syndrome. And so, you know, one of the problems with anticoagulation is we know that it is effective when added on top of antiplatelet medications and secondary acute stroke prevention and patients with MI. Why don't we do it? Because the bleeding is prohibitive on top of combination antithrombotic therapy with antiplatelet agents. But if factor 11 inhibitors are as safe as we think they are, maybe we can be braver and start to use it with combination antiplatelet agents, and hence the interest in secondary non-cardioembolic stroke and ACS.
Bringing back triple therapy, huh?
Yes. I mean, we've spent a decade backing away from triple therapy. It scares the bejesus out of us. And so always makes, you know, make me gulp a little bit when I hear that. But after the results of Azalea, you know, seeing that bleeding is just so much lower than we could have ever really hoped for, you know, far lower than any DOAC, which are our safest anticoagulant, doesn't matter which one. I think it gives promise that, you know, we may have to rethink and expand who we give antithrombotic anticoagulant therapy to, because if the bleeding is so low, you know, we should be more aggressive in reducing thrombosis at risk patients.
Christian, that was awesome. I mean, that was really just a masterclass in factor 11 inhibition, and just love the energy and congratulations again on just a spectacular result, and so much more to come in this field. And you know, I think I and everybody in the cardiovascular community is really excited to see what lies ahead. Before we let you go, I have to say that, you know, I think I first met you.
You were a medical student.
I was a medical student. Yeah, that's exactly right. And then, you know, had the great fortune of working with you as a resident and fellow, and now being your colleague as a at Timmy and at the Brigham. It's just such a treat. And I have to say that you're somebody who I've looked up to for a long time now, and I know that obviously you're a very important mentor to Nick. So we had to take advantage of the opportunity.
So much.
No, I mean, truly, it's we mean that very earnestly. So you know, I guess we had to take advantage of the opportunity to ask you about words of wisdom. You know, what sort of parting words of advice or thoughts do you have for trainees or even kind of early career faculty members interested in doing what you've done and doing cardiovascular investigation, trying to make your mark in cardiovascular investigation?
Yeah, and thank you again for the kind words. It really means so much from the two of you, who I've just loved seeing go through training, and just so proud of just the amazing careers that you've had, and obviously just the trajectory, and just excited to sit back and watch the two of you flourish. And I think the two things that I would say, looking back at my own career as a fellow and then a junior faculty, is, you know, the two things when you're young and in training and a fellowship, really the most important thing is not necessarily what exactly you're doing, but are you in an environment that's supportive and you're building a skill set? So, you know, back when I was a fellow, I wasn't necessarily at that time interested primarily in atrial fibrillation or anticoagulation. I ended up becoming very interested in it, but I learned an amazing skill set, you know, how to conduct clinical trials rigorously, you know, dive into the statistics, you know, understanding pitfalls of trial design. And, you know, when you're at that stage, really just soaking up all of the practical hard work of learning the nuts and bolts of something, those details pay dividends your entire life. You can translate that skill set to any permutation in your career. I've done lipid lowering therapies, you know, anticoagulants, I've done diabetes trials, but that commonality of you know, understanding, you know, the real nuts and bolts of statistics, trial designs, you know, mistakes in trial designs, execution, you know, that's the time where you have, you know, you really are able to take that deep dive. And so it's the process that's the most important part. The exact topic, your career will go left and right, you know, following your interest. And so that's what I would focus on, is really just making sure you build your toolbox, and that's going to serve you well. The other message, and I still remember this, is from Dr. Brunwald, who I think is all of our mentors. And he told me something that I remember as an intern, and he told me it again as a fellow, and it's the most important advice I ever had. It's like, no matter how smart you are, how hard you work, the most important predictor of success in any job, but he was talking specifically about academic medicine, was early career mentorship. And that, if you looked at people who were happy in their job and successful, it was all about early career mentorship. And I remember that, and one of the reasons I came to Timmy, and hopefully you guys did as well, and there are many other great environments, is that is critical for your professional development. You have to find an environment where someone really invests in your career. And it really doesn't matter what you're doing, but they view that your success is their success. And not only are they going to give you opportunities as a fellow or junior faculty to really, you know, take ownership of something and not just do all the hard work, but to get the credit for it, in order to kind of could build your reputation and give you confidence that, hey, I've spent a lot of time doing this. I know how to do it well. There's no replacing that. And so when you look at where you want to do your fellowship or where you want to do your research fellowship or where you want to be a junior faculty, the most important thing is who you're working with. Because those people, if they care about you and they care about you as a person and they care about you developing your career professionally so that it's rewarding and satisfying, you will be happy. You may shift gears 5 years, 10 years in doing completely different things that you did when you started. That won't matter. But in order to get to that point, you need to find a mentor or a mentorship structure that's going to foster your early career development. And that's what you should be looking for. So don't worry necessarily about what you're doing. You know, pick an area you're excited about, but look for someone, look for a track record of mentorship. And if you do that, you will be successful and happy, certainly in academic medicine, but probably in life in general.
Oh, that's so well said, Christian. And you've certainly been one of those mentors for me. And I'm so lucky to have been able to work with you and work closely, learn from you every day. And specifically on our genetics projects that we spent so much time together on, but also trials and other academic pursuits. So, I mean, we really just thank you for that and the impact you've had on both of our careers over the years. It's so awesome. It's so fun to get to work with you. And we really thanks so much for joining the podcast. Great to have you on. We're certainly going to have you back on to discuss LILAC and maybe some
That's
of the
right.
other trials.
I can't wait. Down the pike. I can't wait. Please do. It's just a pleasure talking with you guys. And I and thanks for taking it easy on me.
you bet, Christian. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care. Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, Nick, that's a wrap on our 10th episode of Timmy Talks. We really couldn't have asked for a better guest on the topic.
Absolutely. It was so fun to talk with Christian. And to celebrate our 10th episode, we really want to engage more with our listeners. So please do not hesitate to reach out with any questions about the content, what you liked or didn't like about today's episode, and whether you believe triple therapy will make a comeback by the year 2030.
I think I'll hold out my judgment for a little longer, but do want to echo Nick's sentiment that we'd love to hear from you. Thanks all for tuning in, for listening. And until next time for the Timmy Talks podcast, this is David and Nick signing off.
Thanks for listening. The Timmy Talks podcast is hosted by Dr. David Berg and Dr. Nick Marston and produced by Kate Brennan. Like and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and follow us on Twitter @TimmyStudyGroup to be informed about upcoming episodes.